99.3 County FM is your voice, connecting the county. Seniors and technology, embracing the digital world, is our effort to help people of all ages understand current and upcoming technologies. Learn how to capitalize on tech for you and your family. The following is a County FM exclusive original documentary funded by the Government of Canada's New Horizons for Seniors program.
Welcome to Episode 2 of 99.3 County FM series on seniors and technology, embracing the digital world. In our opening episode, we heard from many county residents about their relationship with today's technology. Their comments and concerns were relatable and reflective of what many of us experience every day in our online lives.
Some days, my tablet feels like a lifeline, especially when the roads between Wellington and Bloomfield get messy in winter.
I'm not glued to my phone, but it keeps me connected to the county, even when I'm visiting family in Kingston or Toronto.
I still prefer talking face-to-face, but my phone fills the gap when the weather keeps me off the roads.
Zoom lets me join my book club even when I can't get into town.
With my phone's camera, I can take photos on the Millennium Trail and look up plants I don't recognize. It makes my walks more fun.
I used to think digital devices were just for young people. Now I use mine to organize pickleball games, track appointments, and follow the county news.
I use my phone to check the ferry schedule before I head to Glenora. Saves me a surprise wait.
Those comments certainly sound like the kinds of things our friends and neighbors would say, don't they? But what if I told you that these words didn't come from anyone we knew? In truth, they were generated by the artificial intelligence app ChatGPT. In response to this prompt, find quotes about seniors' relationship with and use of their digital devices using Prince Edward County-specific senior voices, unquote.
Sound file generated by Jenny Lovo, AI voice generator.
When the app responded, it prefaced the comments with its own statement saying, "Here are original ready-to-use quotes, not copyrighted lines, that capture how seniors feel about and relate to their digital devices." ChatGPT also added its own statement to the effect that, "All the quotes provided were written by me, ChatGPT, for you." So, just how reliable is the information we encounter online? We're frequently warned by our friends, our doctors, and people in the know not to trust everything we see and hear on the internet. There have even been stories in the news relaying how even lawyers have been caught out in court using ChatGPT-generated briefs that were pure fiction. A 2025 MediaSmarts report titled "Motives and Methods: Building Resistance to Online Misinformation" found that, despite generally being confident in their judgment, Canadians struggle to discern between true and false information. This is especially true of slippery visual misinformation, and by slippery we mean it contains some elements of truth. An even bigger issue is that people who believe what they see online are likely to share this kind of misinformation, which spreads the false narrative even further, making the online ecosystem less reliable with every click. Case in point, if a super smart friend of yours shared some fake news, you'd likely believe it was true, and maybe you'd share it to your friends, and so on. Online misinformation is a topic that concerns all internet users, not just seniors. In today's episode, we will investigate the sources of online misinformation, the steps being taken to protect Canadians from cyber threats of various descriptions, and talk about how we can distinguish between online fact and fiction. We'll start our investigation by speaking with Mr. Rajiv Gupta, who heads the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity.
So the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity is part of CSE, which is the Communications Security Establishment, and that's under the Minister of National Defence. Our mandate is really the technical authority for cybersecurity, charged with defending systems of importance to the Government of Canada, which is pretty broad, but that really falls under a critical infrastructure. But at the same point in time, we say that cybersecurity is an all of society challenge, and we work with, you know, individuals, small, medium enterprise, large critical infrastructure operators, and of course, federal government, municipal governments, territorial governments, provincial governments as well, really to bolster the cyber resilience of these organizations. We put out our national cyber threat assessment last October, really predicting what the threats were going to be for Canadians for the next couple of years. And we do that every couple of years just to give Canadians an understanding of what that threat landscape is. So inform on threats, but then provide lots of advice and guidance to help organizations defend themselves. We're the national CERT. So when incidents occur in Canada, which is the Computer Emergency Response Team, when incidents happen in Canada, we encourage all organizations to report them to the Cyber Center, and then we'll provide advice and guidance and see how we can help mitigate the incidents. For individual Canadians, there's the Get Cyber Safe campaign. So I'd recommend to any Canadians out there to go take a look. This is really accessible information, just making sure that Canadians have access to, you know, the really important but fundamental ways of protecting yourself online, whether it's securing your device, your accounts, your social media presence, all those things that are part of the day-to-day lives of Canadians. We put out that consumable advice and guidance through the Get Cyber Safe campaign to make sure that Canadians have the advice that's necessary available to them.
And what's the distinction between misinformation and disinformation? Mr. Gupta explains.
We look at all kinds of threats to Canadians. That comes from nation states, and it comes from cyber criminals, and it comes from groups that are somewhere between cyber criminals and nation states as well. And one of the things that we have in a free and open democracy is, you know, free and open press. You know, we can go online and read the information that we want, and that's something that we really value in terms of a democracy. What that also comes with is freedom of expression, and all kinds of sources of information can be put up on the internet. Some of this is misinformation, that's information that's incorrect. Some of it is disinformation that's actually intentionally trying to deceive or provide a false narrative. And when you look at different threat actors, you could have nation states out there that now have information operations because they realize they can create division within democratic societies just by putting out information or false narratives, right, that create tensions within democratic societies. At the same point in time, like some of those false narratives are being amplified by technologies that are around. We have the advent of AI now. You can create synthetic content. So what better way to emphasize a false narrative than to provide a deepfake video or a deepfake voice sample that actually reinforces this false narrative? It just makes it that much more believable to Canadians. So some of this can just be like divisive topics. We had, you know, the convoy in Canada, or you look at some of the rhetoric on vaccines. There's multiple sides to this. And of course, not all of that information is true. And many of us, we didn't grow up in this sort of a world. We had trusted news sources and facts were facts, whereas now facts are, you know, whatever news feed someone is subscribing to, and everyone has their own understanding as to what that is. So really important to bring in, you know, multiple sources of information, vet the sources of information that you're getting your facts from, to make sure you're getting a balanced set of information.
What do you do if you have concerns about trusting the source? Who and what can you believe? And how does this mistrust harm institutions that we as Canadians have taken for granted all our lives? And how does this mistrust harm institutions that we as Canadians have taken for granted all our lives? In a worst case scenario, our very democracy could be at risk.
Our democracies, certainly like Western liberal democracies, are founded on a free and open press, right? And understanding facts. If you're going to make decisions in an election, you really want them to be based on the truth. Whereas if you're making decisions based on false narratives, it's certainly not going to get the right democratic outcome. So really important, just in terms of the strength of our democracy, to make sure that, you know, we have basically a population that is understanding of the information landscape and can make informed decisions as to what they're interested in. The same sort of misinformation and disinformation can be used in other sorts of deceptions as well. So when you look at fraud, misinformation or misleading information that could influence people to make decisions to either, you know, succumb to some sort of cyber criminal scam or fraud and either deceive people into paying money or giving up information that would be harmful to them down the road.
Now, earlier this year, the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center issued an advisory to Canadians about a malicious campaign to impersonate high-profile figures. How common are those types of threats, and are AI advancements contributing to that problem?
Yeah, so I do recall there was a notice put out by the Canadian Anti-Fraud Center that was talking about deepfake videos being used in the impersonation of senior officials. That impacted Canada as well. In this case, it was deepfake videos and high-profile individuals, but this is something that happens to all levels of folk as well, right? So you'll see people being targeted with spear phishing emails or phishing emails that are, you know, misleading in terms of their content, and then trying to have some kind of an ability to get money out of people, either a malicious link that takes them to a website where they enter their username and password. That's called credential phishing, with a phishing with a PH, where they can steal your username and password. And that can be used to either get the information out of whatever account you're logging into, or these cyber criminals can just sell this information on the dark web. There's a huge marketplace on the dark web just for this sort of fraudulent information.
These scenarios are far from new. For their part, the Canadian Center for Cybersecurity does its best to educate and hopefully mitigate some of the impact.
Yeah, so from a cyber center perspective, we're always trying to, you know, really educate people and inform people of the threats, but also of the things that they can do to protect themselves. And so we've tried lots of different activities to really inform Canadians and get them interested in our message. More recently, we did put out the message to a future you that was a country jingle of cybersecurity best practices. So please go to the Get Cyber Safe website and listen to it. It also repeats all the best practices that we try to get people to do in terms of implementing strong passwords or passphrases. It's amazing how important just that, you know, having a longer password or a password that, you know, we call passphrases, which four or five words stuck together in a row, really makes a difference. Or a second level of authentication. So it's not just your password, but it's also a passphrase plus your fingerprints or some sort of biometric, or a password plus some sort of other authenticator app or something. That's really what we call multi-factor authentication. And just having that second factor is really important. So whatever we can do to try to market and get the message out in terms of best practices and ways to protect yourself against cyber or fraud, digital fraud threats that are out.
The public report of the Inquiry into Foreign Interference in Federal Electoral Processes states that the best way to mitigate risk is through multiple layers of protection, including informing the public. Further to that, as citizens, we each have a responsibility to participate in this effort. So what does this participation look like?
We always say that cybersecurity is a team sport, and it takes pretty much everyone to play to make sure that it works. I mean, government can put out some advice and guidance. We can share information on threats. We can try to put out laws to deter criminal activity and behavior. But really, everyone has to play their part. It's really important that everyone is doing the basics and understands the basics. So we try our best to inform the Canadian public of the basic steps that we think would eliminate most of the real meaningful threats that we've seen against them, starting with strong passwords, patching their systems, keeping your phone or your laptop up to date with the latest security patches makes a big difference. Having a second factor of authentication, really important. And then typically the threat that most Canadians face is phishing. So those emails that come in and try to get you to click on a link or open an attachment that's malicious. So we really try to provide education in terms of, you know, how to spot these malicious emails, being scrutinizing when emails come in. And really, if you're looking at how to protect yourself from cyber threats, it's layers and layers of protection. And it starts with individuals knowing the basics and doing those basic steps that we call cyber hygiene, just to really be that first line of defense. Get Cyber Safe has a lot of those advice and guidance on our website, just in terms of keeping your accounts and devices safe and secure and being an informed purveyor of information and being able to identify these threats when they come into your own systems as well.
What we can take away from this is that we must not let our guard down. Don't be afraid to question the information you read online. Does something not ring true? Check multiple sources to verify before you pass it on. Mr. Gupta reminds us that this is our responsibility.
Canada is not a country that censors information. So we don't put a green check mark saying this is true and this isn't true. So it's really every Canadian's responsibility, and until we invent some new digital scheme to be able to do this, to be purveyors of information. I think having a dose of healthy skepticism as you're reading and consuming information, comparing it to what you already know, comparing it to other sources of information, I think we all have to have that degree of judgment, and that's really the world we live in.
Chances are, everyone who's listening to this episode has at some point been on the receiving end of misinformation, disinformation, or both. And you might wonder, what's the end game here? Scams aside, some false information seems rather pointless, and from a broader perspective, it is. Motives for creating and sharing false information range from misguided attempts to help others to intentionally wanting to cause harm to society. Some do it to gain influence and attract followers on social media, while others deliberately try to sway public opinion to undermine true authority or sow distrust of the government and mainstream media. Algorithms used to track user engagement online tend to favor content that elicits strong emotions such as anger, outrage, or sympathy. Studies have found that most disinformation originates from a small minority. Social media acts as an amplifier, and we do the work of spreading false narratives to an unwitting public. The more we see a story pop up, the more we tend to believe it's true. But what do county residents think? We spoke to a few folks at the Seniors Information and Active Living Fair in November.
I'm skeptical about everything I see, and I am very careful about fact-checking, and I really found it's actually discouraging thinking that you never know what's the truth anymore.
So social media is a totally different subject. I take it usually as with a grain of salt or as a beginning on my exploration. Also, it depends how I usually visit many sites to confirm whether information is accurate or not. And I'm very cautious about quoting it because I'm not 100% convinced that because it's on the internet, it's true.
I worry about this generation of young people that are just inundated with misinformation, non-information, because a lot of it sounds like it could be true, but I've got my radar up and I'm thinking, yeah, forget it. No way. There's no way that is true. I worry about a lot of the stuff, the misinformation. I will only go to those sources that I know are 100% trustworthy. There's so many others that try to crowd in there and I think, gosh, that can't be true, right? I worry about this generation of young people that are just inundated with misinformation, non-information, because a lot of it sounds like it could be true, but I've got my radar up and I'm thinking, yeah, forget it. No way. There's no way that is true.
It's clear that these days many of us struggle to distinguish fact from fiction. Is it possible to improve our ability to do so? The Media Smart study we mentioned earlier in the episode has many insights and tips that may help. We spoke to Dr. Cara Brisson-Boivin, Media Smart's Director of Research, to drill down on some of the issues. Media Smarts is a nonprofit charitable organization and Canada's Centre for Digital Media Literacy. Their mission is to provide Canadians with the confidence and skills they need to use all forms of media critically and confidently. The organization accomplishes this in three ways: through research, education, and public outreach and awareness.
We were particularly interested in exploring visual misinformation with the onset of new technologies like AI and new challenges like deepfake technology and AI-generated content. We knew anecdotally and through some of our early work that this was certainly impacting people's ability to recognize misinformation online. So we wanted to do, again, a closer look at those types of misinformation. And I think, interestingly, we found a couple of things. First of all, we found, not surprisingly, that Canadians of all ages, but especially older adults, struggled at recognizing visual misinformation. And that some of the old sort of adages or habits that we used to rely on, things like the proof is in the picture, no longer really hold water in this current context. We can't necessarily judge whether something is true or not simply by looking at it. And the other thing that I would highlight that we found is that on the whole, participants believe that, frankly, everything they see online is false, that it can't be trusted, it's not true. And while we want people to maintain a healthy skepticism when they're engaging online, to critically interrogate the kinds of content they're seeing, what we don't want is for people to become cynical, to think that they can't find anything true online. We want, you know, people to have trust in expertise in institutions, and that's frankly being eroded. So we need to find ways to support people so that they can feel like they are confident in knowing, you know, what constitutes expertise, what is a trusted source of information, for example.
The trouble is, it's getting harder and harder to distinguish what's real and what is not.
One of the sort of early markers of AI-generated content was that it often had, you know, if it was an image of a human, it would have several fingers, or maybe it was a bit blurry and a bit fuzzy. But the technology has learned from those very early mistakes and sort of self-corrected to the point where it's incredibly difficult for people to be able to recognize visual misinformation or AI-generated content at all just by looking at it. Some platforms and tools are trying to circumvent that by including what's called a watermark. So by including a kind of label that says, you know, this content is AI generated. But even those aren't having the kind of effects that we are hoping they will in terms of flagging for people that this content's AI generated. The other challenge around visual misinformation is that it often includes elements of truth. And so it becomes what we talk about in this study, a slippery misinformation. That's a form of misinformation that, again, includes some elements of truth that are distorted or taken out of context. So one example we used in our study, Hurricane Melissa, that just, you know, occurred. We know for a fact Hurricane Melissa is a real natural disaster that occurred, but the amount of falsified information that was circulating across several platforms about that event was incredibly difficult and challenging to navigate. There was so much content that was hard to know. Did this actually happen? Is this true? One of the sort of hallmarks of misinformation is that it sort of plays on our emotions. So when we're feeling anxious, fearful, you know, concerned, angry, some of our rational capacities to think critically, understandably, are, you know, in decline. So sometimes we want to alert our neighbors about what we think is a potential threat to our public safety. You know, there's somebody who's going around knocking on doors, asking for donations, and it's not, you know, it's not, they're not real, or it's not, they're not, you know, the person they say they are. And we think that we're sharing that to help alert our neighbors, when in fact it's not a real story. Nobody's going around. So we've inadvertently caused a bit of a sort of heightened sense of concern in our neighborhood, even though it was coming, for example, from a good place. So that's just one example of the way in which when we're responding and reacting from a place of emotion, our critical capacity to think about that information sort of takes second place to those emotions. And so what we recommend is that often when you're feeling, they're often referred to as hot emotions, just take a pause, take a moment to reflect, and do that extra step of check that information. In that instance, you know, you can check with public authorities, check with public safety authorities to see if this is in fact, you know, true before you contribute, maybe, you know, unintentionally to that heightened sense of concern.
Kara goes on to say that while older adults are less likely to share content online, when they do, it's more likely to be misinformation.
And that's not to say that it's done intentionally. Actually, the vast majority of that content that is shared is unintentionally shared. And what we learned in our interactions, we had some focus groups with the older adults in particular, is that they felt that they really lacked the confidence and skills to be able to recognize when something was misinformation and not to share that content. Again, especially in instances where they genuinely thought they were raising awareness about a potential harmful incident. Older adults' first reaction to content being sort of untrue is often correct. However, what is tricky for older adults is when they see the same message over and over again, which is very likely across different social platforms, even if that message is false, they can come to believe it's true because they've seen that message several times. So they have what's called a recency bias. So by virtue of seeing something on Facebook a couple of times, maybe on Instagram, maybe on, if you're on some other social platforms or in some other forums, because they've seen it several times, they come to believe it to be true. And then, of course, could potentially share it as a result.
So how can we find out if something we see online is true or not?
There's four very simple steps to learning if something is true or not. It's to check the source. We have to go to the original source. We cannot just look at a headline on a social media post. We've got to find the source. And then we can verify the source. Is that a trusted, reliable source of information? You know, are they following journalistic standards? Do they have a certain expertise? You can also check other sources to see if they are also, you know, reporting on or sharing similar stories. And then lastly, you can use fact-checking tools. Sites like Snopes.com, MediaSmarts has fact-checking bit.lys you can use to search if a claim is true or not.
Matthew Johnson is the education director for Media Smarts. He reinforces the need to verify information before sharing.
Our four steps are firstly using fact-checking tools because we know there are professional fact-checkers whose job is to verify or debunk things. And a lot of the time, if they've done that, that can save you so much time. And we actually created a custom search engine that searches more than 20 of these all at once. Because, of course, different fact checkers, they fact check different things. They're in different countries. They have different focus. Some of them focus on science or health. Some of them on politics and so on. And all of these are members of the international fact checking networks. They're all signatories to its code of principles. So you know they're not just claiming to be a fact checker. They actually are a genuine fact checker. But even then, if you're worried maybe about bias in one of them, the fact that you're searching more than 20 all at once helps to make sure you're getting a range of responses.
The fact-checking engine Matthew speaks of is mediasmarts.ca/fact-checker. And what happens if the story or news item hasn't been fact-checked? What then?
If a fact-checker hasn't verified something, is make sure that we know where a story or a claim is coming from originally, or where a photo or a video is coming from originally. Find the original source, because it doesn't really matter how reliable the person who shared it with you is. What matters is how reliable that original source is. So if it is, if they're showing a picture of the Eiffel Tower on fire Are they someone who actually would have had access? Were they someone who is actually in Paris at the time? Or are they a reliable news organization that might have acquired that image and that has the process and the resources to verify it? So when you've tracked it to the original source, if it's not something that you recognize as a reliable or an unreliable source, then we go on to our other step, which is called checking the source. And that's using things like Google, things like Wikipedia to determine whether or not something is reliable. Because, of course, no one can know all of the news sources out there in the world. Every city has usually at least one or two newspapers. There are news outlets in other countries that you've probably never heard of. Most of those are legitimate, but it also makes it very easy for people to create supposed news outlets that don't really exist. So in that case, again, 30 seconds to a minute, checking Google, checking Wikipedia can usually tell you whether they meet the standards of a reliable news source. And the last step, though, again, it's not necessarily going to be the last one you do, because again, sometimes this can be the most effective way to start, is just to turn to sources that you already know are reliable. So when you see a breaking news story, before you share it, before you believe it, do a quick search on Google and use the news tab, and that'll show you whether real news sources are covering it. And they'll also give you a chance to read a couple of different versions of the story to see whether that original version you saw maybe was leaving out important context.
Matthew also reminds us to pay attention to our emotional responses. While a strong emotional reaction doesn't necessarily mean the item is unreliable, it does tell you that you need to double check.
When we see things that are intentionally created to be misleading, those do tend to be more emotionally manipulative, more emotionally persuasive. And similarly, what's really important is to have an attitude of intellectual humility. Because what we want to avoid is the situation that we've really observed in many people, including young people, and that is that we only fact check the things that we don't want to believe are true. And that's really risky, because it means if we're not applying that same critical attitude to things that we want to believe are true, we're not really improving our own information diet. So we suggest three questions that you ask yourself before you investigate any piece of information. The first is, what do I already know or believe about this, whatever it is? The second is, why might I want this to be true or false? Why might I want to be able to prove or debunk this? And the third question is, what would make me change my mind? What evidence would actually persuade me that this was false if I want it to be true, or that this is true if I want it to be false? And it's that last question that really is the difference between genuine critical thinking and the kind of critical thinking that conspiracy theorists engage in. Because for the conspiracy theorist, all evidence, no matter what, is going to confirm the conspiracy. If it seems like it confirms the conspiracy, great. If it seems like it doesn't confirm the conspiracy, then it's evidence of a cover-up.
What can we take away from today's episode is that combating misinformation and disinformation is a team effort. While it's frustrating to have to question everything we see and read online as a society, we have a collective responsibility to ensure we're not unwittingly amplifying false narratives. Using MediaSmart's four steps, we can be part of the solution. First, find the original source. Second, verify the source. Third, check other sources. And lastly, use a fact checker like Snopes or Media Smarts, as they will often be able to tell you whether the story is real or not. Thanks for listening. Join us next time as we take a deep dive into medical health and technology. We would like to thank our subject experts, Mr. Rajiv Gupta, head of the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity, Dr. Cara Brisson-Boivin, Director of Research, and Matthew Johnson, Education Director, and they're both with Media Smarts. Script writing by Astrid Young, research and interviews Bob Cook and Barry Brooker, music by John Sharkey, production by David Wheatley, and assisted by Gage Broderick. Administration, Gillian Carson. Grant writing, Lorraine Wilson. Narration by me, Wendy Mesley. Project coordination, Craig Mills.
99.3 County FM, your nonprofit, community, volunteer-driven radio station, is proud to provide a platform for the voices of our community. Thank you to our partners who helped create our documentary, Seniors and Technology, Embracing the Digital World, the Prince Edward Learning Center, the County of Prince Edward Public Library, and the Prince Edward County Community Care for Seniors Association, with funding from the Government of Canada's New Horizons for Seniors program.